Is it tragedy? Is it comedy? Whichever it is, American Players Theater is bridging the gap of 2,500 years to bring Euripides' play Alcestis to the stage, and we're going to find out how they're going to do it. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me are American Players Theater Artistic Director David Frank, who's bowing out as director with this play. Also with me, David Daniel, who plays both Apollo and Heracles, and Melissa Pereira, who plays the doomed Alcestis, plus a couple of other parts, and Marcus Trushinsky, who plays her death-cheating husband, King Admetus. Welcome all to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
Looking forward to some scenes, of course, from the play, but there's a lot to get into with the play itself and the periphery of it. But I have to ask you first, David Frank, as an outgoing director here, how did you come to this play, and how did it play into sort of your usual modus operandi as a director?
Oh, I have a particular fascination, I must admit, with the, not so much the Greeks, although they fascinate me, but the combination of those ancient Greeks 2,500 years ago and really great 20th century poets seems to me a particularly muscular, vivid, freeing kind of chemistry that just fascinates me. I was actually looking at that combination, going through various poets that I admire, and I came across this one as part of it fairly early because I've always been a fan of Ted Hughes. And the moment I finished it, actually before I'd finished it, I knew I wanted to do it really badly.
And, you know, this whole translation, a free-ranging translation apparently, has not been done often, I gather, because it wasn't even published till what, 1999, a year after Hughes' death?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hughes never saw it performed. He left specific instructions as to which company, a northern company close to his birthplace, as to who he hoped would perform it, and indeed they did, and they took it to London. And to the best of my knowledge, I can only track down one other professional production that happened in this country. There may well have been others, and I'm sure there have been university productions, because Ted Hughes is a giant of poetry. But it's certainly not produced very often, though.
In this country, at least, I don't think you can mention the name Ted Hughes without mentioning, of course, the tragedy of his marriage to the American poet Sylvia Plath, who
yes.
took her own life in 1963 after, I think, 7 years of marriage to Ted Hughes. And this play that we have is about another couple that just happens to, you know, have a wife who is slated to predecease her husband, let's say.
Oh, yeah. I think there's no question that death was a major force in Ted Hughes' life, and not only Sylvia, but his lover and partner of the next 6 years also killed herself. And Ted Hughes must have known that he was dying while he was finishing this play, probably during the course of writing much of it. So that the exciting thing about, I mean, it sounds like a grim, grim subject matter.
Yes, it does, it does.
But this play is actually about transcending death. Yeah, death is something we're all going to face. And maybe with the cloud of retirement or whatever it is hanging over you, it seemed like a good moment for me to go, okay, transcend.
Do you think there's guilt in this play that also tapped into something in Ted Hughes' life?
Well, I think it, yes. And there is one particular line when you go, oh, I bet that's about Sylvia. But it's only one line and it fits into the, you know, to, it doesn't have to be. But I think it is about transcending that guilt. I mean, if there was anything that this play comes down to is live life while you can. Live it vividly and wholeheartedly, because there's no point worrying about what you can't control. And it is the coherent, vivid, exciting conclusion of the play.
Does Ted Hughes and his translation adhere to the structure of the play with the the chorus and the way that the lines are delivered?
Well, the way that lines are delivered is is a question for each production and this extraordinary company that I was lucky enough to get for this. Ted Hughes' version is about 50% longer than the original Euripides. So he adds a vivid, all of the labors of Heracles, which Heracles acts out in this play, and which are fun and vivid and
12 of them, aren't there? Is all 12?
Yeah,
of them?
Well, he doesn't act out all of them.
When we say Heracles, though, the more familiar perhaps Roman would be Hercules.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, no, sorry. It's Hercules is now more, the Latin version is now more common, but they're the same.
So we get some backstory, is that what you're saying? In the Hughes version.
Yes. Now, we get those labors there, although it's not in order to fill in backstory. It's in order to really embrace life in a most vigorous, on the moment. And then also it's the way that Hughes takes us in from those rather glorious labors, which are fun and great storytelling, full of great stories, tips over into the nightmare. And that really allows Hughes, and this is original Hughes, and it taps into the Prometheus legend. And one of the things that happens when you put a 20th century poet with the Greeks is that a 20th century poet is actually freed by the conventions of Greek theater.
Sure.
Because now suddenly you can have a chorus. You're not bound by literal rules. You can also take advantage of myth, and Hughes was fascinated in myth too. So Hughes actually follows the Euripides story pretty very closely, but then he adds to it. And because Hughes is a great poet, and because it's a very free translation, and some of the speeches are very different, even if the general shape is the same, he makes this very much a 20th century piece.
And how do you go about making it a 20th century piece? Any of you?
Well, the nice thing is you're not quite bound by this kind of stand and deliver Greek interpretation. We have to make all these characters real for ourselves.
And for your audience and for the 21st century.
But the nice thing about it, too, is we have this beautiful, beautiful poetry, and then all of a sudden that poetry turns into real language, and the real language can be very, very stirring and realistic.
It worked for Shakespeare, among other poets, playwrights.
But you have almost these kind of a time out from reality where you can speak this really, really beautiful poetry that kind of transcends reality, and at the same time you still have a very, very real thing that's very, very playable for an actor between two actors.
Well, it's also cuts. It's not just the beauty. It's the cuts. The scene that Admetus has with his father is brutal, and it's poetry that makes it just cut right to the bone. Mm-hmm. You know, go throw your sticks in bed with that other half corpse.
It's
startling.
Go off on your wife.
Death head. It's very brutal.
Potent stuff for a father-son conversation.
Well, potency, I think, is a really key word when it comes to Hughes and a lot of those 20th century poets, because it's not florid like Shakespeare. That's the beauty, and those strong metaphors can be very florid and beautiful. This is so potent, so distilled, gets down to the essence of what's being said in often monosyllabic vocabulary that just cuts right at you.
It's incredibly simple when you first look at it, and you get it immediately at one level, and then you suddenly discover that this very simple, short sentences, no pretension whatsoever. He uses whatever word is necessary, and if a simple one-syllable word will do it, he does it. And then suddenly you realize it may be simple, and it explodes in your mind.
Now, when we say poetry, are you talking about poetry with meter, or is something freer than that?
Way freer. Although it's fascinating. When we first do it, when we first play with it, very often you feel it really doesn't matter much to the syllable here or there. And then as we got more and more expert at it, we'd always find that even though it is blank verse, even though the meter is unpredictable and there's absolutely no rhyme, I can't remember any instance when he uses rhyme, probably avoids it. But suddenly we would miss the syllable, and you'd go, it was better than
the way it was written.
That although it is subtle, and you know, if you miss a foot in Shakespeare, it kind of screams at you.
Yes.
And everyone goes, ah! That doesn't happen here, but it is better.
Well, before we hear the opening monologue from the play, why don't we set up the premise? I mean, it's a very simple premise to this, although it's rather strange to contemporary ears. But if you take yourself back 2,500 years into the world of gods and fate, what is the premise of Alcestis?
Well, if we go right, the first bit that David is going to read for us is the opening speech of the play. So you need very little premise. Perhaps it helps a little to know that even though the first reference he has is to a palace, so it's obviously, and everyone knows that this is an adaptation of a Greek play, we actually try to set up a tension at the opening with a little bit of a surprise, and then there's a kind of silence, and all you hear is a rather rapid heartbeat, and David comes in. You see a figure upstage, walks through the light. It's clearly dressed as a doctor, and he is concerned, worried. He's not even looking at the audience. Then he turns round, and the speech begins.
A strange thing is happening in this palace. Incomprehensible. Only to those whose eyes are too narrowly trained on the wrong causes. A woman is dying in this house. She is giving up her life so that her husband can live. And this is the day of her death. I am partly to blame. You may call me a god. You may call me whatever you like. But a god greater than I am, the greatest god, is guiltier than I am of what is happening here. That greatest god was jealous of my son. Think, my son was a healer, Asclepius. Note the name. My son could bring the dead back to life. He should be here today. Asclepius. Perhaps you've heard this story. The great god, the greatest of the gods, the maker of the atom, is a jealous god. A thunderbolt split heaven and killed my son. The dead must die forever. That is what the thunder said. The dead are dead, are dead, are dead, are dead forever. They return to the pool of atoms. You know what I did? I avenged my son. I killed the electrotechnocrats, those titans who made the thunderbolt. But none of that is important, except as a dim, forgettable cause of what is happening now to the dying queen, Alcestis. In everything I say, remember her. Remember what she is undergoing now, this second. And this, inside this house. Let every woman who hears me imagine it is happening to her. God punished me for my revenge. He made me the slave of this woman's husband, me, a god, the common slave of a king, King Admetus. However, Admetus is a remarkable man, a savior of his people, an inspired prince, a man for whom the whole country prays. God made me his slave. His dream became my work. His people thought he must be divine. The whole known world was astonished by the prosperity of his kingdom. Unluckily, Admetus was doomed to die young. But I knew how to free him from his debt. Believe it or not, on occasion, fate will accept a substitute. Yes, sometimes it is possible to persuade fate, vast and faceless fate, to accept a substitute. My persuasion was successful, and now Admetus can live. If only some other person, some kindred, will agree to give him their life and take his place on the other side of the grave. A difficulty. Now, who do you suppose would die for him? His old father and mother, two walking cadavers? Both refused. Their voices rose to a screech. They wanted only to live. They set the example. Admetus sat in his bedroom, you might say, with a terminal illness. I canvassed for him. I was shameless. I asked everybody who boasted sharing the slightest family link with Admetus. But, of course, I was asking for more than a kindness. I was asking for their heart, so to speak, to be cut out of their chest and stitched into his. Only one person I did not ask. Alcestis. His wife. But now you know her story. Of her own accord, she has volunteered to give him her life. And death has accepted hers for his. All that matters now is how Alcestis makes the gift of her life and dies for her husband, and how he accepts her gift, this incredible gift of life.
Well, there you have the premise for the play Alcestis, written some 2,500 years ago almost by Euripides, and being produced by the American Players Theater as part of their season. David Daniel there giving you the premise as the god Apollo, who in this production will be dressed like a physician, and there is some appropriateness to that, right? Because yes, Apollo is, you know, connected with healing, as mm-hmm. was Aesculapius, his son. Mm-hmm. And is there any discussion as to why the fates provide this loophole? In one version of the story, it's because Apollo gets them drunk, right?
That's the only version that really matters.
Yeah. It's the only way to get around gods.
Which right away, I mean, if we knew this, I don't know if it's a factor in Ted Hughes' version of this play, but if we knew that this whole thing was set in motion by the fates being drunk, I mean, it's hard to make it 100% a tragedy, seems to me. Although
sure.
There is this manner of thinking that, you know, God is not dead, as they used to say back in the 60s. He's just drunk.
Which accounts for all kinds of irregularities.
Yes, it was a cult called the Inebriatists, I believe.
Oh, but, it's a long tradition.
Yes, but it's a wonderful premise there, David Daniel, that you have set up, because it makes it quite clear in this play what has set everything in motion. But now the focus has to center on Alcestis herself, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As to why she has made this choice. Why has she made this choice as
you know, we talk about
die?
It in the play. It's selfless love. It's loving. What are you willing to do for love? Anything. She is so... But at the same time, like any human being, she's also afraid. But she wants to do this. And I try to work on this role every time, I can't help but think of my own experience of death. And, you know, my mother died before my father, and she was only 43 years old. And whenever we get to this scene that we're about to do, I can't help but think of her sacrifice. And she left her children behind, as does Alcestis. And so it's very personal work for me, being able to kind of play the sacrifice and make it beautiful and ugly and real all at the same time, because it is.
And again, David Daniel, as Apollo in the beginning, says, you know, death, 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 death. Your atoms are broken up and sent back into the primordial pool. There is nothing to look forward to in his opening description of what's at stake here.
Mm-hmm.
But does...
Except his life. Except Admetus' life.
Well,
that's
yes.
what she has... That's what she gives, and
right.
to know that after you are gone and you are nothing, that you left something, and that was the life of the man. You gave life to the man you loved, and what is greater than that?
How does all of this square, if it does, with this, and I don't want to, you know, get into this too much for reasons that will be obvious to you all, how does this idea of returning to the atomic, subatomic pool square with the Greek notion of the underworld, though?
Oh, well, I think that I'm not sure that's important. I do think it's important to mention that, yes, indeed, the play starts with a determined nihilism, mm-hmm. And that you know, clearly, although atom has its origins in the Greek language, the concept of the pool of atoms that Ted Hughes presents to us is very much 20th century.
Yes, sure.
Although compatible, oddly. Mm-hmm. Melissa describes very beautifully and very accurately the impulse that drives Alcestis. What is important to remember is that that's early in the first act, that we propose two things early on, both of which are to be modified and changed and complicated as the play drives in its 2 hours. It's fairly short. So you start with that nihilism, that terror of nothing. No, I mean it. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Just imagine it. Nothing.
Which, of course, points to the sacrifice.
Then we introduce one other idea of total selfless love, which is funny how often that's associated with the most beautiful miracles than ever. But anyway, then that play will then deal with Admetus's guilt, because what's very important, and it's not evident in the couple of extracts we'll do, is that a central underpinning of the play is Admetus allowed this to happen.
Right.
And he is going to be made miserable, perhaps as Ted Hughes was, by that guilt. And how the play transcends that is its true power and beauty. Now, that put into play early on is the extraordinary beauty of the Alcestis sacrifice, self-sacrifice, which he does gorgeously. And, you know, that will return, of course, at the end of the play. But it is also very much, it's not just that, it's very much about how we deal with guilt, how we deal with fear, how we deal with the unknown.
Well, we're going to look further at this play. We're going to look at doubling of the roles. We're going to look at more at guilt, and we're also going to look at a loose cannon called Heracles when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests. They are members of the American Players Theater and include David Frank, who is bowing out as the artistic director of the organization and is also directing their production of Euripides' play Alcestis. And with me also, three of the actors. They are David Daniel, who doubles as Apollo and Heracles, and Melissa Pereira, who is Alcestis and has a couple of other roles included, and then Marcus Trzeszynski, who is Admetos, the king, who has made this deal with the fates through Apollo. It gets a little complicated, but the bottom line is that Admetos can avoid death if somebody else will just step in and volunteer to die on his behalf, and the volunteer turns out to be none other than his wife after a few other candidates have passed it by. Now, you've told us a little bit, Melissa, about why Alcestis agrees to do this, but what's in this role for her that really brings this out? You know, what makes this an important role, do you think?
I think the play tells us that she needs to do this, not only because she loves her husband, but because the whole kingdom depends on him, and that he's needed throughout. He's not just avoiding his own death. It is something that is going to help a lot of people. So I think it's a sacrifice that she does in order to save millions, ideally, right, in her mind.
Is that the way you feel about it, Marcus, as the king? Are you doing this purely out of civic duty and altruism?
Well, I mean, if you're playing the character, you can never look at his negative sides. You have to make the positive choices in order to make him a kind of a living, breathing person. But I feel like he has this kind of sense of self-importance that he imagines with this deal that he makes with Apollo and death, that he imagines his parents are going to give their lives for him because they're very much dying. They're near the end of their lives. And he imagines that his parents would make that type of sacrifice for him as...
And for, of course, the state.
Yeah.
For everybody.
And when they do not volunteer, they say no, they make a trek through all of his relations, every kin he has, and everybody says no for him, which probably should have been something telling, you know. But Alcestis decides to make this sacrifice for him, and once he realizes that, I mean, he throughout the play, it's a struggle with the realization of that gift for him, how he has to live, how he has to grasp life. I mean, the play is mostly a meditation on, for him, on how to accept love and how to accept this life and how to live with this guilt, essentially.
I think it's important. Yeah. One of the choruses even states that he's never had to accept the negative. He's never had to anything bad happen to him. He's always been blessed, and mm-hmm. that this is his first taste of the starkness of life, of what can mm-hmm. what life can offer. And even in the dying scene, which we'll hear in a little while, he's still fighting it. Like, no, there's yeah. hope. We can still get out. We can figure
down
out a way
to the
to
last
get out
second.
Lisa spoke eloquently about the justification that many chorus members and absolutely is in the play that everybody needs Admetus. Now that question is put into doubt by some voices too, and there is.
So this is not a unanimous chorus.
No. Actually, one of the things that I think this company has just done. I've been just blessed with an extraordinary group of actors. It was the final gift to me before I stepped down was to get this company. But each of those chorus members, and we've actually divided them, there's a kind of servant chorus and an outsider chorus. So we have the younger chorus and the not quite so young chorus. each of them has an individual character. And there's, a young boy and then there's, one chorus member who always thinks the best of everything, even to the point going, come on, it's not that good. And there's one voice that is always a cynic and so on and so on. So there are all those different views in play there. The play is not simplistic. And Melissa says elegantly how, one of those voices there. She also, though, when she dies, also that ultimately she does it for him. That it is the quintessence of, I would say, the best aspects of all religions, which is selflessness. Yes, a bit hackneyed, but finally it comes down to love.
Yes.
And Hughes gets to that. He gets to that actually quite early in the play and beautifully in the scene that Melissa and Marcus do so wonderfully.
And then can we hear this is a scene, and I imagine it's the same one I've seen pictures of in some of the materials from American Players Theater, the scene in which Marcus as Admetus, the king, and Melissa as his wife Alcestis sacrificing herself, and it's becoming real now. It's becoming something concrete in this realization.
Yes, at the very top of it, we've heard about her. What's going on off stage, and that Alcestis, we now know this is the day. We don't quite know when it's going to happen in the course of the day, but we know that it's imminent. And then suddenly in comes one of the servants, and almost immediately followed by Admetus and Alcestis, and we suddenly realize that the time is very imminent.
The sun... The great good warmth of heaven. Clouds that made all our happy days such a bountiful procession of hour after hour, when life seemed unending.
The god of light up there has hard eyes. He is watching us. He sees only two figures, two clay shapes in a crypt. like two jars full of wine whose taste is their own secret.
The hills, the houses, my place, Iolcos. I see it all as if I had already left it. Here before me and here after me, as if I had never lived.
You will live, Alcestis. You cannot leave me. Pray, pray, Alcestis.
What is that black river? Do you see the river, the glitter brimming among the houses? Somebody, who is it, Admetus? Somebody out on the river shouting for me. Shouting my name. I hear the splash of an oar.
Ignore him, Alcestis. Pray. Pray with me. Pray with me.
A huge cold coming down over me. Huge weight. A huge hand of ice pressing me down. Admetus.
Fight against it, Alcestis. Fight for your children, for me. You are taking us all with you. Fight. Pray.
Let me lie down. So heavy. The strength I had has all gone into weight. Goodbye, my darlings. Remember, I loved you. Don't waste the sun. Be happy.
Goodbye. Don't use that word. Only live. 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 Live and stay with us.
Admetus, you are making words meaningless. Accept what is happening.
Why? Maybe it need not happen. You can live, Alcestis.
And that's the first portion of that scene. There's more of it.
Yes, where can I go from there? I mean, he keeps telling her to live. And, of course, this gets gets to be a bit of a conflict in the mind of the king, I would think, who has been looking for this volunteer to take his place. But this has been called a problem play, Alcestis, by those who think, was it comedy or is it tragedy? You know, this is that old...
Aristotle is to blame for that.
He really is, isn't he? Because
old pedant that he was.
Right. It has to, 24 hours, it has to be the same kind of atmosphere or tone, comedy or tragedy.
And he got disgruntled generally about Euripides, who we thought was the beginning of the devolution of great Greek tragedy.
But, I mean, so far, in fact, if you look up Euripides as a, tragic playwright. Mm-hmm. And this play so far is tragic. But then we inject, or the playwrights inject a character that really seems like a loose cannon. And then it's suddenly it goes comic. I mean, at least it appears that way. And is this how you're playing it when Heracles comes rolling into the house?
Well, I think comic isn't the word I would use. I would say heavily contrasted with the mood that has been set before, which is what you want from any play. You just want the conflict, whatever those two sides are. And so I think it is a respect. I don't think it's a carelessness of life. It's not throw life up. It is a deep, loving respect for life that means live life to the fullest at any second. Now, he is invited into the home, or he inserts himself into the home, and when he finds out that there is a funeral, he leaves. But then his friend Admetus persuades him to stay. Do you want to talk about why in the world you would want to do
that? But first, of course, he doesn't know that there's been a funeral.
Well, Heracles doesn't find out till the end. Yes,
because Admetus issues this order that says, "Don't anybody tell him he's a guest, and we don't want him to share in our grief."
That's exactly it. And he, because this is an old Greek tenet, the hospitality and what it meant to people, that is in this play. And I think it was one of our most difficult decisions that we kind of had to make in the production was why would somebody in a modern sense do this? And I think it's along the lines of that kind of selflessness. He, in this terrible, terrible moment, his best friend comes to the house, and in order to keep him there, because he desperately, desperately needs somebody and something, some love from somebody, he feels like he needs Heracles, that presence, that hope, not only in the play, but for Admetus to be in the house with him. So he kind of grasps onto it and says, no matter what, no matter how everybody feels about it, this is something that I can do. This is some good that I can put into the world.
Well, even one of the choruses mm-hmm. ask you directly, if he is such a great friend, why not tell him that there's a funeral, that your wife has passed? Why not do that?
Because it would put him out. It would make him leave, and it would – he's on this journey, I feel, and the best thing that I can do is to keep him ignorant of that, because I feel like it would destroy his lifeblood, and I feel like it's something that
– more selfless.
Well, yeah. Plus anything to keep him around. Apparently.
So suddenly two central themes get addressed here. One is, as Marcus so rightly points out, that Greek concept of hospitality, which was terribly important to them at a time when there were no facilities for travelers, when traveling was dangerous, and yet the Greeks were great travelers. Their civilization was to a significant extent dependent on that concept of hospitality. So you get two things, though, that meld with one in this fascinating moment of the play. Marcus's character, as he so well says, has some deep instinct that says, because he knows that if he tells Heracles that there's a funeral going on, Heracles is out of there.
Right.
And he desperately needs him. So you have one, generosity for Heracles' need in the concept of hospitality. At the same time, you have intuitively, not intellectually yet, that won't happen until way late in the play, the idea that living in either your guilt or misery and just being terrified by life because it isn't perfect, which is perhaps the great central insight of the play, which is live while you can, because
good
it's glorious. And without knowing it, Admetus has actually begun that journey too. And that those two things coincide with love and self-sacrifice. Self-service in terms of getting the most out of life can in this play take the form of service to other people is, I think, the profound insight.
There's a wonderful psychological insight, though, in that even in the depths of grief, a person needs some levity, wherever that comes from. And Admetus has that with Heracles, and we, the audience for this play, Alcestis, have it when Heracles comes in as... Is it hard not to steal the show? I mean, because what Heracles does, I mean, he comes in without and not knowing that there's a funeral in the house. I mean, he comes in and gets drunk, right? And just kind of like careens around.
He does, but it's about the idea of life. I don't think it's what David, it's what we've already said. It's just the idea of life, and that the drinkingness is not necessarily drunkenness for drunken's sake. Mm-hmm. It is an embrace of let's have a good time, let's party, let's
celebrate life by
by enjoying all of its riches.
And I've heard that on State Street.
Well, unlike what you would find, well, perhaps unlike what you would find on State Street, it is a celebration of community. Well, I say that now. That can be a celebration of community as well, but it's a celebration of community, and it is embracing every moment. And I think what David talked to me about Heracles early on, it I was sitting in his office. I said, "Well, you know, I'm kind of not that guy. I don't look like him, and he's this." And so I took some time to figure out what Heracles was for me. I'm a big fan of the Greeks. And then I realized for this play especially, we could find the part of Heracles, which is life, and that his labors are not about I am the strongest or I am impenetrable or I am the smartest, but that this – he says it. Hughes gives him a great line. I take these things as they come. Mm-hmm. I've never refused a fight. If this is my fate, so be it. This is my fate. I'm not going to back away from it. And he'll say to Admetus, you can't mourn before – we're all going to die. So it makes no sense to ruin today with that. So live it. Live it full. But when death comes, then you mourn. Then you pay your respects. But not before that. So I think what I tried to find with this Heracles is not the drunken reveler. Heracles can be so many things. It's not the drunken reveler and the superhero, but just a man who embraces life, the man that you want at your party because he just has this thing about him. It's like, okay, we're going to put him in the corner because we don't want him to scare anyone, but he's still great to have around the party.
I use this word, cautiously, but is that part of Heracles really the most fun part in the play?
Oh,
yes. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yes.
Well, and awesome. As a person, I get to be on stage with David during the labors. And as a person who shares the stage, it's impossible not to be – his energy is contagious. And I think that that is his purpose in the play. And I think he does infuse the audience with life and that it is built in there in the structure, obviously. But I think David just does a really great job at storytelling, which is what the labors are about. And you can't help but lean in as I listen to him do it every night, and I've heard it over and over.
You're dead by then, aren't you, though?
I get to be a chorus.
Oh, that's right. We haven't talked about this role doubling. We'll get to that in a minute.
So it's really beautiful and really wonderful to get to hear and feel the audience being fused by this life that he fills us all with.
And the idea of hope comes in there, because we all fall in love with Alcestis, the great sacrifice that she makes, that we all wish we had the strength to make when the time comes that we could do something like that.
Well, yes, she's young and beautiful.
Yes. And does this beautiful thing for her husband. And so in some point, we're all like, well, it's got to work out at the end, right? I mean, she's going to come back and something's going to happen, some miracle. And here comes Heracles, who's done all these labors. And you're like, can he do it somehow? Will that happen? And you get this idea of another great theme of the play is this idea of hope. What is hope? And do we hope beyond hope?
Another Greek theme, of course, you know, Pandora's box, who's the last one to come out, you know, is
right.
Hope.
Yes,
sure.
That's right.
Let me ask you in particular, David Frank, the director, but anybody can have a pass at this, laughter. I mean, is it a tightrope to walk? I mean, I saw The Seagull earlier when you produced that, and toward the beginning, you know, there's a scene where the audience laughs, and then afterward you're thinking, maybe we weren't supposed to laugh there. Is this play a bit tricky that way?
I have always felt that many of the greatest plays, when you work on them, we as directors, actors, designers shouldn't particularly care whether an audience laughs or not. Now, if you're doing outright farce and they don't laugh, you feel really silly.
Got that.
When you slip on that banana skin with the bowler hat and the suit and everyone, unless they cry. I sometimes think that laughter is... Oh, you know, people have been arguing since Aristophanes 2,500 years ago as to what the source of laughter is.
Sure.
And many times I find myself saying, much ado, David and I and Colleen had this conversation, do we care whether they laugh on Kill Claudio? Mm-hmm. And we finally said, we don't care. Well, that's up to them. We'll try to do it truthfully, although it is an incredible story switch. And they do laugh because the truth suddenly dawns on them. Mm-hmm. But it's not because we wanted it to laugh. I feel much the way, the same of this play. The end of it actually is influenced by Shakespeare Act Fives, and Hugh was very conscious of that. Winter's Tale, perhaps, although it's not directly.
It's been compared to, yeah.
But it works extraordinarily because the audience knows what should happen, and they're almost certain is going to happen. And what the play keeps doing is going, imagine how wonderful it will be. It's about, no, it's not. Oh, no. So, and Shakespeare pulls that off in these great comedies in the fifth act. Mm-hmm. And you look at it and go, but they know the joke. How does that work? Oh, surely it's not going to work. And then you just trust and do it. And is it laughter or is it delight or is it beams of smiles? Mm-hmm. And is it a tearful moment?
I think great thing about this play is somebody told me after seeing the opening of it that there were four people in the group, and each of them in the car as they were going home had four completely different opinions.
And that's true of the critics too for this play. In fact, it's been pointed out that it's not only do they not agree, they don't agree on anything about this play.
I think that's good. I mean, I feel like if we're telling a story that people can argue about or go home about and not be able to categorize, I think that's a great night at the theater.
Isn't that true of the great, whether it's Shakespeare or Chekhov? Mm-hmm. And isn't that true maybe of art? that if it is so definite, as it must be personal. It must be a journey for each person. Otherwise, we're back to the preface. And I have great admiration for science and math and its precision and exactness. But it's when those tools no longer work that you need to paint or to make music or to create a play. And the truth is something that we recognize as being true, but how we personally work that truth into our own philosophy is very personal.
And this play proposes all of the questions, but it doesn't give you many answers. And I think that's your job. That's your job as an audience member to say, what does this play mean to me? How did this particular part touch me or didn't, or and why? And yeah, we can only do so much, right? And it's great to be able to be in the Touchstone where we can – it's a place where you can leave a lot of open-ended questions.
Some final thoughts about Euripides' play Alcestis when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guests. They're all associated with American Players Theater. They are David Frank, who is directing the production of Alcestis, and some of the players are with me. They include David Daniel as Apollo and Heracles, and also Melissa Pereira as Alcestis, and she has some other roles too, and then Marcus Trzynski, who is King Admetos. And for Admetos, Alcestis has agreed to die on his behalf and for the good of the people also. And this is part of that dialogue that they have about that unusual situation.
After your death, any man in Thessaly would have leapt to marry me. I could have lived here in this house with him. But without you, I could not live. I am still young. I gave you my first best years, and now I give you the rest. It is simple. My life was yours when I lived, and now, as I die, it is yours. When I am dead, it will be all yours. It is all a piece and all yours. Who else has such good reason to prefer your life to their own? Your father and mother gave you your life, and now they are old, now they have used their lives up. They cannot see that they owe you anything. Either of them could die at any moment, but the scrap of time left to them is more precious to them than you are. But we are not dealing with people. We are dealing with a god. Admetus promised me one thing, only a small thing, nothing to equal what I have given you. I think you love our children as I do. Admetus, let them be masters in their own house. Do you understand me? Do not take another wife to be jealous of them, to persecute them, to make their lives a curse. Do not, Admetus. The boy might survive it. The boy has you. But what of the girl? A stepmother will tear her to pieces one way or another. And the boy? Where will he turn for the love cut off in me? From her he will drink poison, subtle and sugared maybe, but poison. You cannot watch over them. These two will be in her power, and she will secretly destroy them in the shadow of her own children. If any can come back from the dead, those two will bring me back to protect them. Promise me, Admetus.
You have my word. I promise. I promise. Oh, Alcestis, I love you. As I have loved you alive, I will love you dead, only you. No other bride shall ever be mine. There is no other woman so beautiful, so loftily born. Why should I need more children? If only the gods will protect them. They are all I have of you. I shall mourn you, Alcestis, not for a year, but for my entire life. And for my entire life I shall detest my mother and my father, who would not throw off their carcasses to save you. Alcestis, only you, in the whole world, only you loved me in word and in deed. But weeping and groaning cannot fill up this chasm, this total emptiness. No mourning can ever be enough. From today, this house is closed to banquets. No more parties. Henceforth, laughter is forbidden beneath this roof. For the last time, I have heard merriment beneath this roof. I swear this before the gods. Alcestis, everything has gone with you. What shall I do? Have some sculptor make a model of you? Stretch out with it in our bed? Call it Alcestis? Whisper to it? Tell it all I would have told you, knowing it can never be you. Horrible. To dream you have come back, alive, happy, full of love as ever, then to wake up. I find myself thinking about Orpheus in the thick of all this, thinking of the impossible, how he went down there into the underworld, the dead land, with his guitar and his voice. He rode the dark road on the thumping of a guitar, a horse of music. He wrapped himself in his voice, death-proof, a voice of asbestos. He went down and down and down, you remember? He went for his dead wife, and he nearly got her. Death let her go on one condition. Orpheus almost saved her. But he loved her too much, too helplessly. He made a little mistake. He made it out of love. A tiny error, unthinking, a glance, think of it. Only a backward glance, and he had done what he should never have done. At the crucial moment, he lost her. Horrible. Wait for me, Alcestis. When I die, we shall lie together forever and ever and ever and ever. We shall not be separated then till the whole universe crumbles.
Well, a poignant and poetic scene between a husband and wife in a very unusual situation from the play Alcestis by Euripides, the voices of Melissa Pereira and Marcus Straczynski in that particular scene. A quick word about doubling the roles. Does it help you, Melissa, or anyone else? Marcus is the only one who doesn't get to double in this play.
Scot-free.
Does that kind of help you a little bit emotionally to get into another character?
It's interesting. When I get to come back as a chorus member, we have kind of set up a convention as to what happens, you know, when Death comes in and he is now a chorus member, he does the same things that I do. So I put on an apron and I become a chorus member, and he puts on his glasses and he becomes a chorus member. So there are little things that happen to let the audience know, hey, we are now this person.
Sure.
But it's great to not be cut out from the story. It's great to see what happens after, to get to continue to be a part of the play. And we went back and forth on that, you know, as to how, when should I come back? And regardless of what happens, my face is still Alcestis'
sure,
face.
Yeah.
And we've used that, I think, to our advantage. So there are certain scenes where, you know, her name is being mentioned and you get that resonance, you know, that of my face, regardless of whether I intend it to or not.
There are, I think, two kinds of doubling, and we use both in this play. There's when it is absolutely obvious that David Daniels here as Apollo is a totally different character from Heracles. I mean, they're dressed completely differently, and the same as for Jim Ridge when he becomes the dad. But there's another kind of doubling when you take advantage of the fact that this servant who happens to come in at that moment, you go, oh, that was Alcestis, and they're talking about her. And so sometimes the double can actually, and we use it for
a little bit of irony.
Too. Oh, and resonance.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, speaking of resonance, I think you get quite a bit in this play, Alcestis by Euripides, and it's been a pleasure having all of you with me. The director of the play, David Frank, and we've also had David Daniel and Melissa Pereira and Marcus Straczynski, and a pleasure having all of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can be listening next time around for University of the Year.